Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TeamCast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Mission Critical Team Institute. The TeamCast is a show where my colleagues discuss all things mission critical teams. Mission critical teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a mission critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the TeamCast.
Hi, folks. I'm Dan Dworkis, and our guest this episode is Alex Hodson. Alex is a critical care physician assistant with 7 years in the front lines. She describes herself as a professional adrenaline junkie with passion in both patient care and leadership. She's deeply invested in the dynamics that drive high-functioning teams and healthcare systems and is a vocal advocate for the vital roles that APPs play within them. Alex, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm honored to have you here. We've had some great conversations off podcast, and I'm really hoping that we can bring some of that same energy to this today, because I think this is just such a really important area to get into.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's always an honor to be included in things like this, but especially with the recognition that there needs to be a space for APPs in this.
Absolutely. Okay, we've done this a little bit before in prior episodes, but it's been a minute since we've tackled part of this issue. So for folks that are coming to this either from outside of medicine or from outside of the US system, can you give like a 2-second overview of what APPs are and like how they fit into the whole thing? Understanding that, of course, like you don't speak for all APPs any more than I speak for all doctors or anything like that, but we got to start somewhere with it.
Absolutely. So APPs is the modern terminology for advanced practice providers, which really includes PAs and NPs in particular, at least in my world in the ICU. And the goal is for it to be a more inclusive term in the inpatient setting, since my NP colleagues and I share the same job description and function, rather than differentiating based off of our training or background, we're doing the same job. So it just puts us under that same title. But basically, we are advanced trained providers. We work with supervising and collaborative physicians as part of the multidisciplinary team, especially in some of the higher stakes environments like critical care, to offer a better framework for patient care and make sure that we're getting different perspectives and overseeing different parts of day-to-day workflow.
Yeah. There's some really interesting pieces to that that are like not obvious that this is your first time leaning into this space. First off, just to be really clear about this, so Alex and her team are on the front lines taking care of the sickest patients in the hospital, in the ICU, right? They're there 24 hours a day taking care of these folks, doing procedures, like running decision-making and doing it collaboratively with this larger team, but really as the effector arm of a lot of this work. And that's incredibly high-paced and incredibly sophisticated stuff to be doing. This is perhaps different than an older and more incorrect view of what PAs and NPs do, which is more of the grunt work and extending the job of a doctor and not the critical thinking skill set of it. And I think that's older model of it. And it's worth putting that down at the beginning. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about elite level critical care.
No, I appreciate that. I think that's a great point to be made. I think every one of the tricky parts about the APP realm of medicine is that there's a lot of gray area. So a lot of it is dependent on the system in which you practice, the physicians with which you practice, as to how wide of a scope and autonomy that you're given. Obviously, in critical care, there's such a high need for those patients. We have a lot of high acuity patients. One patient alone can take up a provider's entire day if, you know, all the holes in the Swiss cheese kind of align, so to speak. And so we have to be able to practice really at the maximum of our scope and have physicians that support that, rather than, like you said, some of those older models of having us do the quote-unquote grunt work or things that are not as maybe beneficial for billing purposes or something like that to free up the physicians. But it's definitely become a more collaborative network between our physicians and APP counterparts.
So just to hit some of these facets of this, so the type of work we're talking about is very advanced, high-level decision-making. Oh, we got a cat on the screen. This is great. A little bit, we're keeping that in there. That one's staying.
Always.
We have really high-level, sophisticated work that we're talking about. We have work that is, by definition, multidisciplinary. And actually, maybe we should put these terms down. So we're probably going to draw a line between multidisciplinary and multi-professional, right?
Correct.
So multidisciplinary, and fix anything I'm saying that's wrong here, but multidisciplinary is more like when you think of, say, surgery and emergency medicine, or intensive care and pediatrics or something, different sort of vertical disciplines, or maybe horizontal, I don't know what direction that goes, but different disciplines that are within the same space. So you can have two doctors next to each other or two APPs next to each other, and they can be trained in different disciplines. And then at the same time, we have multi-professional, which is really, we're going to say, coming from different schooling backgrounds is the best way to describe that. So the pipeline, the arc of education that it is to become a nurse practitioner is different than it is to become a doctor. Although those two individuals might work side by side in the emergency department or in the ICU, right? So that's a multi-professional team. And there's a bit of a convolution between the path you took to get there, the way you were trained to think, and your skill set. And those are very different, but likely entangled a lot of the time to some degree. So we have work that is multi-professional. We have work that is team-oriented, that is really sophisticated. And the other facet that's really interesting is that you have people that are doing sort of, in quotes, the same job, but they come from very different backgrounds to do that same job.
Exactly.
And that breaks. Yeah. And then the same title might be doing very different jobs across different hospitals. So there's like a local effect to it too, as if it's not complicated enough without that.
I know we like to keep things complicated in the EPP world, but that's definitely how I would describe it. You can have two PAs or two NPs, but depending on their specialty and system of practice, that day-to-day workflow may look very different. So a lot of it is figuring out as an APP going out into the workforce, the things that you're really looking for as far as how much autonomy you want, the support that you want, you know, the multi-professional work and workflow that you're looking for, and then finding a team that's a good fit for that and is going to help you grow as a provider.
So, Alex, one of the big threads we keep poking at in the podcast is how do we train individuals to be members of the really sophisticated mission critical teams that it takes to deliver this kind of healthcare. So can you take us back in time a little bit through your training and how you got to where you were? And then maybe as we're doing that, we can cast off laterally from that in terms of what other pathways might look like.
Absolutely. Feeling like going very far back, but back to undergrad. And at first, I really didn't know that PAs were an option. I just knew I wanted to go into medicine. I loved to take care of people and the puzzle of figuring out what was going on with the human body, which is so fascinating. And going through undergrad, the pre-med route, and during one of my summers, doing all these different internships and shadowship programs, and worked alongside an NP and realized that there was this other realm or option where I could practice. That didn't mean I had to go to the degree of being a physician, but that would still allow me to do all the things that I cared about in my medical career. And then graduated from undergrad, went straight into PA school, which was, like they say, drinking from a fire hose, to say the least. I think I've been parts of training for both PAs and NPs, and we always say that there's, you know, pros and cons to both, and neither is superior or inferior. They're just different. And having to learn how to tailor the education coming into the ICU for either of those groups. So the strength on the PA side is we are taught on the medical model, which is the same as our physician colleagues. So we speak the same language from the get-go. We have a very similar focus on pathophysiology, differential diagnoses. And so that part is the quicker, smoother process for us. And then we have the more challenging part of having to overcome a lot of that, like, imposter syndrome of not being at the bedside. This is all very new to us, feeling not knowing where things are, getting comfortable doing procedures and talking to patients and being in that multifaceted, critical, mission critical team. versus a lot of our nurse practitioners. They came from being critical care nurses. So this environment is not new to them. They're just in a different facet or role in it. So they come in already with a lot of the understanding of the team dynamics and communication expectations and workflow and comfort with patients and procedures and things of that nature. And for them, it's more having to uptrain that side of the medical piece, putting it all together, making decisions as the provider and carrying through all of those and having that extra level of responsibility. So once I graduated PA school, I was, again, very lucky, got my dream job straight out of PA school and went through pretty much a critical care, we call it boot camp, but residency for several months after I had had the opportunity to rotate with that same team a few times during my rotation. So I knew what I was signing up for and they knew what they were signing up for by getting me. But it was a whirlwind of sink or swim for a while there, but also one of the most rewarding experiences for sure.
So you come out of PA education and then move immediately into critical care. And that's an interesting thing that doesn't happen in some of the other training pathways, right? So in physician medicine, for instance, right, you go through residency and then critical care as a fellowship on top of that. So it's an interesting sort of transition space. Can you dig us in more to that spin-up process, that boot camp, whatever you want to call it? Like, how do they actually get you ready to go from school into operating on the lines there? And as you're talking about this, we're going to keep in the back of our head what we've talked about in the podcast before, the idea of the July problem, right? Which is, at least for doctors, right, as you go from medical school to residency, everybody hits in this wave in July. Everybody moves up in this time in July. And it causes just massive problems. Just massive problems. So what do you all do for that? How do you overcome that? What's that ramp up process look like?
So I think the way that, and again, different residencies or fellowship programs are structured differently. Most of the ones that I've been familiar with or worked with have done one of two things. They either bring on a lot of providers and are training a lot of providers for a rapidly growing system, but they stagger them. So you always have people that are at different phases in that process of from the first couple weeks to maybe a couple months ahead of them, so that people are going to different sites, they're focusing on different things, they're overseeing different levels of responsibility, they're maybe paired with different providers at different parts of that process based on what their strengths are with oversight and teaching. And then some of the other programs, that's the one that I went with, was of that structure, which I loved, having people that were a month ahead of me, a month behind me, and we could all kind of work together and have an idea of what the road was going to look like ahead. But other programs will usually take very few providers. So they'll do one or two or maybe even three, depending on department size, and they'll train them all together in a cohort, which again, there's certainly benefits to. I think that's probably maybe a little bit of a smoother transition from being a student because you're almost still in this small class-like structure. I think as far as really having to develop your confidence as a provider, having to feel comfortable standing on your own, having to be comfortable with the uncertainty and the things that I think can help really build your resilience around the stresses that we see in the ICU, having to stand on your own 2 feet a little bit earlier in the process is, I felt, beneficial. But a lot of it starts with the preparation. And I saw the full circle of this because I went from being a student with them on rotations to being more or less a resident with them in their training program. And then, spoiler alert, but years later, after getting out of that, went into leadership and then was one of the people that were hiring our incoming residents, but also precepting and teaching them and helping to get them where they needed to be. So one of the things that we would really focus on is the preparation, that you want to choose people that are doing this for the right reason and know what they are signing up for. There is no benefit of them getting in thinking that this is all going to be a sugar-coated, easy-peasy experience. And then once they get there and find out that's not it, at that point, you have invested a lot of time and effort, and the company's invested a lot of money in these providers that then realize this isn't for them. So it's really talking to people and asking them, tell me about a time you failed. How did you handle that? We all got into this or got to where we are in our careers because for the most part, we're pretty high achieving type A personalities. We don't like to fail. We don't like to not do well. And that's something we struggle with. But coming into critical care, it's a guarantee you're going to suck for a while and you're going to suck at a lot of things at a lot of different times. And so you need people that are of that growth mindset rather than that fixed mindset of, I might not be good at central lines today, but that doesn't mean I can't be good at central lines tomorrow versus I suck at central lines and I'm never going to be a good provider. So asking them times that they have failed, how they handled that, making sure that they are prepared to really be bad at something and stick with it to get better. I think making sure that they're open and aware of the feedback that is about to implode their life. Because we're used to all the feedback that we've gotten up to that point is typically pretty structured through like school, right? You get feedback in the form of grades or numbers or comments here and there. Maybe your preceptors gave you some feedback if you asked for it, but you probably haven't gotten a lot of that really specific constructive feedback or criticism that you are about to be inundated with. And I would tell my residents, like, I only have, let's say, 6 months to get you from baby provider that, you know, is putting on their long white coat for the first time to being able to run an entire hospital at night alone, making life and death decisions, running every cardiac arrest, every admission, every consult, every family conversation, every procedure. And I have to feel confident in 6 months that I can get, or a year that I can get you there. And that doesn't leave me a lot of time for all the warm and fuzzy stuff. Of course, still wanting to emphasize when they have done a good job and giving them that positive reinforcement and the specifics of what they did well that time. But if that's all you focus on, then you're not really able to get them through the areas of opportunity that they need to be where they need to be in 6 months. So a lot of it on the preparation, making sure that their family and friends know what they're signing up for and are prepared to see them go through this process. Long hours, you learn a lot about yourself and getting all of that feedback and just having people that understand your why and the fact that this is going to be worth it. It's just being able to support you through that rigorous phase of it. Not that it necessarily gets easy after that, but it's certainly a different degree when you're under that microscope of everyone watching you and questioning your decisions at all times is a different degree of intensity.
It's funny. So this is what we're recording right now is going to be episode 118. And yesterday, as it turns out, I was recording episode 117 with Sean Griffiths, who's a ER doctor that trained in the Air Force that does a lot of work training ER residents. And he said, because I'm flipping one page in my notebook here from yesterday, he said, you only have a few hundred shifts until you're alone when you go through training. And it's my job to take them through those, to teach them to suck everything they can out of every one of those shifts, because it's just going to be them alone in the middle of the night in the future. And I love the parallelism between that and what you just said. Like, I only have this amount of time to really spin them up for it.
Exactly.
I hope people listen to this podcast anyway, because I think that's fun. But I hope that when they are listening to it, they're able to see that sometimes in medicine, it feels like there's a huge difference between the different professions. I feel like there's a huge distance, right? That we came from different places. We think different things. We train different things. We want different things. But here are two people who are at the top of their craft, training the next generation of individuals coming behind them, who said literally verbatim the same thing. I only have this much time to get them ready. How do I do the best I can in that moment in order to make that happen? I love that. Like, what a cool parallel structure. And
that is funny. That does come full circle.
Yeah. And what a great charge. And as I was saying to Sean, you know, I wish I'd understood that more when I was coming through my own training.
right? Like I certainly got enough of it, right? I certainly got enough to be able to stand on my own afterwards. But I wish that I really had that attitude for it the whole time. Because there were times when my attitude was more of this sucks, right? Or this is terrible, or we're just surviving this. Sometimes you got to just survive it in order to get to the next thing. But I think it was only when I was later in my training that I really realized the gravity and the gift that the other doctors, the other practitioners and the patients were giving me that ability to learn from them.
Absolutely. And to be fair, I think there are probably days and shifts that we can all remember from our training where we felt like, ugh, this just sucks. But I think especially,
just a couple.
Yeah, I knew it then, but especially when you're on the other side and you're the one doing the training and understand just how much of an investment you're putting into these providers. You're emotionally attached to them. You want them to succeed. You're giving them a lot of time and energy and focus. You're having difficult conversations with them. You're almost having, there's this misconception of if you have a trainee with you, then good, there's 1.5 providers on today. Not really. There's half of a provider because it's almost taking away a lot of my time. I could do something far more efficiently on my own. I could intubate or put in a central line or have a family conversation quickly. But then if I have to oversee the trainee that's doing that and be patient and be willing to let them learn and make those decisions and mistakes and guide them, then I have to be patient. And it takes longer, obviously, for a reason, but it's such an investment. And so you realize that all of that suckiness or those shifts or times or preceptors that you felt were giving you a hard time, they were actually investing in you because they cared and believed in you. And again, just with the timeline and the gravity of the decisions you're going to be making and the responsibility you hold, we all have to train providers that we're going to be comfortable with taking care of our loved ones. So that sometimes means doing it in a loving and supportive way, but definitely having to focus a lot more on the places that need growth rather than the places they excel.
I have since gone and apologized to a few of my teachers over the years for being a punk. And if you're one of those people that I've apologized to, you know who you are. But I think I'm very grateful for the chaos that they put me through. And I think it's interesting because not everybody ends up feeling that way. And I wonder if, in some sense, you and I are having this conversation because we've both self-selected into careers where uncertainty and chaos is a norm, right? Like, I'm sure that the people who are outpatient family care providers who work amazingly hard, who I am grateful that they exist, but like, I'm not sure they have the same sort of mindset about some of this stuff, which again, maybe gets back to this difference between multidisciplinary versus multi-professional. Because you and I might have come from different places, but we are at the same sort of like coal face or whatever you want to call it, like doing the work for it. I don't really think I have a question there. I just think that's an interesting way to think about it.
I think you're right. I think I've always wondered, and it's one of those questions that I will jokingly ask my team and reflect on that's a little rhetorical, but it's always, did critical care make us this way, or did we end up in critical care because we are this way? And because you'll see a lot of personality traits or personality types that are drawn to these high stakes professions and thrive in that uncertainty, thrive in that challenge, high-paced environment, high-stakes decisions, and find purpose in that rather than being discouraged by it or feeling stressed. That's almost where they find their comfort in the chaos. And I think I always tell a lot of my best friends from PA school went into kind of the outpatient family medicine or urgent care world. And I tell them all the time, I'm so grateful for them because I could never do that job. I would be
totally
terrible at it. And they say the same thing about what I do. And it's just, we can both be strong in our specialties, but they are different for a reason. They attract people with different mind frames that work better under different circumstances.
So we've poked a little bit about the idea of prepping people early in a pipeline for this piece of it, for what they're going to hit when they start training, because we know there's going to be this step function of responsibility and
and need for operational command or need for, I don't want, that's probably not the right word, need for operation. I'm just going to leave it at that and we're going to keep going. Right. We know that step function is going to happen. We have to train folks for that ahead of time. The other thing I want to come back to is this concept again of multi-professional critical care. When in your arc of training did you really start getting introduced to that concept? When did you start getting introduced to the idea that part of your job is going to necessarily be mixed within this team of people that come from different angles?
I think from the beginning. And I think that's one thing that I felt was really important in my training that I try to instill in everything from the students to the residents and fellows that I work with over the years is practice like you play, right? So we play as a multidisciplinary and multi-professional team in these chaotic environments where patients' lives are on the line. And you have something to learn from every single department or piece of that puzzle. And we couldn't do it without one another. For example, in my training, I thought it was really beneficial that from the get-go, you're working with different, so both within the APP realm and then outside of it. In the APP realm alone, you're already being working with different preceptors almost every shift. So at the time, yes, there's downside to that and you get frustrated because, you know, someone will show you how to do an A-line their way or how to work up a patient for X, Y, or Z their way. And the next day you'll do that perfectly and the person's, what are you doing? Who told you to do that? That's completely wrong. Don't do that. And so you start to learn what is the science versus the art of medicine and picking up tools in your toolbox from everyone you work with. And then when you get out of training, being able to select which tools match your way of practice and your art. And sometimes it's, well, in one circumstance, like I lean on the skills I learned from person X, and maybe I grab tools from some of the other providers from my training in different circumstances. But early on, you also get, I think it's really important to insert the APPs in the training environment into nursing education, physician education. So we would have our physicians that would sit and do lectures with our residents because one, then they have a stake in the game as well. They have now invested in these APPs and want them to succeed and have gotten to know them better. The APPs feel they have a better relationship with their collaborating physician, so they feel more comfortable being able to ask them questions or learn from them in the field. But you're also getting different perspectives of how to handle some of these different pathophysiologic states. And I think, like, I'll even nowadays, when I have students, I'll see if, depending, you know, what the unit looks like at the time, if they can go with the echo techs for a couple hours, if they can go hang out with rapid response, if they can go down to the ER and see the other piece of the puzzle before we get the patient and let them see as many perspectives as they can so that they become the best, most well-rounded providers that can not only understand and see other people's perspectives, but also can plan for it and also develop a respect for those positions, recognizing how much they all do.
Perfect. Alex, I'm going to give you a magic wand here, and I'm going to tell you that you can do anything you want. And your job is to build a training pipeline, either from the ground up or modify the existing one, that's going to take folks through the pipeline from college through PA school into critical care PA life. And you just identified, I think, one of the key components of what you'd want that to look like, which is contact across boundaries early and often, right?
Yes.
What else would you do? Right? What are you going to change? What are you going to put in place from the training that's going to make that team at the end of the day the best team that it can be?
So I think, like you said, early and often crossing of those lines, I think in an ideal world, I would even say back at the degree of PA school and NP school and med school to be working with one another, even as students then, because again, no matter what environment you end up in or specialty, these are skills that you are learning of how to work together and utilize each other's strengths in different forms. So yes, I think integrating each other into our training, I think I'd also probably put a lot more emphasis on the human factors and that art of medicine. So, you know, you can sit and read a textbook all day and learn about cardiogenic shock or septic shock, and then find a patient that has a little bit of both and try to learn all those things. But it, like we've talked about before, that last mile problem of taking that knowledge that you have at the textbook level and being able to apply it to the patient. And you can do a vignette online, right, to maintain your license, and it'll ask about a patient case. And you're like, oh, easy, it's that solution. It's answer A. But in reality, to get answer A done and to get it done effectively and to have a team that's going to trust in your decision of answer A when maybe answer C seems like a close second to some, how you handle those human factors in those stressful environments and build the resilience on the front end so that we don't have this environment so much of fake it till you make it or trying to push yourself until the point of burnout. And then I think also just having that ongoing education, the ongoing feedback, the ongoing structure and mentorship, because we get through this residency or these training programs where you've had someone sometimes begrudgingly at your side all the time, giving you feedback all the time and telling you ways that you can grow and improve and teaching you new things all the time. And then suddenly you're on your own and you're probably like in a lot of hospitals, you're working by yourself. You're working on night shifts or day shifts where there's either not the time for a lot of it or there's not the resources or the people to continue to get that feedback and learn from. And so suddenly you feel like you've grown so exponentially in such a short period of time. And then while, yes, you do still continue to learn and grow and adapt your practice and get that confidence, you also feel like you've stagnated a little bit because you're not getting that ongoing feedback and support and structure. And you also don't feel like you're necessarily in that safe space anymore of I'm learning. It's okay for me to ask these questions, even if they sound silly or even if I should know them. You tense up and think, now I've been deemed as being competent to work on my own. I can't go back and ask those questions then. And so you stagnate both from feeling comfortable asking those questions, but also the feedback. And I think ongoing, more structured mentorships and environments that keep us all growing and also all holding each other accountable across, again, those boundaries and disciplines would be my ideal world.
Do you know of any places where they have multidisciplinary or multi-professional group mentorship? Where like you go in and like you're mixed together with physicians and PAs and nurses and you are all actively providing, like some places have 360 reviews, right? Where you get like a review from everybody, but that it's not really the same thing as what you're describing, which is, hey, we're going to proactively go and mentor each other to try to get better at it. I think the closest that I've seen is when I worked at some really small places, right? Because everybody there is in it together. And there's this sense of it's like y'all versus the universe because you're it. And that has this effect of having this sort of group mentorship. But I don't know, have you seen anything like that?
In some shapes and forms, yes. I think a lot of it ends up being logistics that make that challenging. Again, because if you're working by yourself, it's hard for people to give you feedback on your performance. Or if you work across numerous different locations with different teams, then it's harder for people to be able to assess your abilities and strengths and opportunities. I think typically, unfortunately, what healthcare tends to rely on is the more structured leadership, like performance review concept for feedback of you have your APP supervisor and your medical director. So they'll give you feedback and they'll give you reviews and scores and grades like what we're used to in school. But that's not the same thing as that closeness and comfort of having a mentor that's going to continue to help you grow and will learn from you as well. So I think most cases I've seen of that have been much more informal than formal, and people just bonding with particular people that they feel are as passionate and want to learn and teach as much as they do. But it would be, honestly, I think the closest thing I've probably seen to something of that nature is MCTI and how that's that safe space where a lot of those walls and boundaries come down, where it doesn't really matter what letters come after your name. It's what is your mission and what is your purpose and how can we all make each other better and learn from each other's backgrounds. And I think that's a really beautiful thing if we could bring that more into medicine.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Obviously, strong agree. This is why we're doing what we're doing. But okay, so we spent a bunch of time thinking about the pipeline here, right? How do we build people into these teams? Now I want to spin it forward and think about, now we're in the ICU. We have this multidisciplinary, multi-professional team. It's a random Thursday night shift or whatever it is. Tell me about that. What does that look like for you when you're there? What are the strengths that you've seen? What do you want that team to look like? You still have this magic wand, so you can build it into whatever you want, but what do you want that multi-professional team to be doing?
So I think that's one of the blessings and curses of the ICU and ER and anything like that, is having to be certain with the uncertain team. So you can have a shift where you don't sit down once and you get 10 new patients that are incredibly sick, but you can also have the shift every now and then where, I know we're all hesitant to use the Q word, it's quiet and calm and you are just waiting to see what comes in the door. But I would
edit
say
that word out later.
I know. We're not superstitious, but we're a little stitious.
Exactly.
And that's definitely one of the ones that we hold off using inside hospital walls. But I would say, especially in some of those more high stress or busier shifts, having a team that's in sync as far as knowing what their roles are, being able to divide and conquer and trust each other's abilities and capabilities so that you're not doing the same work twice, allowing people to work to their strengths. So for example, if you get a patient that comes in that really needs to have one of those difficult family conversations, and you have a provider on the team that no one likes to give bad news, but finds a lot of purpose and value in those and is strong in them and gives the family the information in a kind, compassionate way that they need, then all just falling into your roles and definitely communicating back with where we all are with all those patients, where, you know, at what points we need to catch each other up. I think that tends to be what makes that chaos feel more controlled than all of us trying to tackle the same tasks over and over again, which is just inefficient. And then you have too many cooks in the kitchen. So divide and conquer, everyone maintaining their composure, not letting the stress get taken out on one another, and circling back and making sure we haven't missed anything, that everything has been accounted for and done to the best of our abilities. And then debriefing on it, ideally.
Yeah.
I don't think we do that enough, especially on those stressful days, right?
Sure.
The whole point is it's so busy up until the time you get to leave the hospital, usually fairly late. But we tend to do it after high stress or high stakes events, you know, cardiac arrest, or like I run a debrief after every intubation, cardiac arrest, almost arrest, anything like that. Difficult family dynamics or situations, but we don't really debrief on shifts and how we think, how did the day go? How do we think we handled the influx of patients? What do we think we could do better tomorrow in a space where we really feel calm and comfortable being honest with where both we and our counterparts could have maybe handled something more efficiently.
So one of the wrinkles for this for me is that when you are part of a multidisciplinary, multi-professional team, we're talking about how in an ideal world, we're dividing and conquering. We're using each other's best skill sets. We're in sync with each other and not duplicating effort. And sometimes it's really challenging to know what the other person is likely to be doing, what their background is, what their skill sets are, and what they're doing. And who was it? I think it was Ray Dalio, maybe, who in his investment firm has like playing cards for each person, where they'll come in with, here are my top skill sets. Here's what I'm strongest at. Here's what I'm weakest at. And when they sit down for a meeting, they'll put the cards on the table and look at it, be like, okay, here's how we might be able to solve this problem most efficiently. But we don't really have that. And everything that we said at the beginning of this conversation about how there are different pathways, there are site-to-site differences in what those skill sets and structures look like. There's even like fiefdoms within that. So even within a site, there's this yo-yo culture effect of what you do on shift might not be what I do on shift. And so the people that are around us and with us like have this sort of like whiplash effect to it. And you know, when I approach these kind of teams coming from the medical pipeline, the ER pipeline, all of that, if you put me in front of another ER doctor of some stage of training, I have a really good idea of what they're supposed to be able to do, right? I understand where they're supposed to be, what they're likely to fail at. I can tell you if it's January of their second year, they're probably depressed, even if they don't know it yet, because that's about the amount of time they've missed some family events. It's dark out. They're not seeing as much. Like you can just, that's like a dip and then they'll get better.
It's
again.
Respiratory season. So you get all the
exactly.
Flu.
Yeah. And like maybe depressed is too strong a word, but they're certainly lower than they might be otherwise. And I can tell you if there are three, then there's an X percent chance that they've made a really big mistake or not yet. And you can tell the ones that have made it and haven't made it yet. But I don't know that for PAs. And I don't know that for NPs. And even within that structure, I don't know that for this person or that person. And there's a real challenge in there, right? If excellence for us looks like what you described, and there's this very like complicated web of things that get us into that room together, man, how do we square that circle?
I think that's a great question. And I don't know if there's a perfect answer for that out there as of yet. I think a lot of that is a two-part answer. And part of that is we have to have the self-awareness to know ourselves, to know what our strengths and weaknesses are, and have an accurate representation of how we handle these situations. And again, some people are better under stress. Some people are better with procedures. Some people are better with families. Some people are better with being able to put the pieces together at the computer screen, whereas other people would rather be at the bedside. And we're all different in that way, but having a true accurate representation of where we fit in that and being open to feedback that helps our self-awareness. So I actually did this with my team this past year for evaluation season where we did Johari Windows because I'm thinking of curtailing it to medical practice, but just to see if we actually have accurate representation and viewpoints of ourselves versus each other. And it was very eye-opening how a lot of us maybe don't come across the way that we think we do. And that translates into trust and team dynamics and the ability to proactively, so to speak, be able to read the mind of and stay caught up with your colleagues. So I think the self-awareness piece, having to be able to have open feedback, but also some of it is having to be in the trenches with one another and see people on good days and bad days in different scenarios and how they handle it and debriefing with them after and realizing, okay, maybe this person is really good at running cardiac arrest and this person's really good at putting in the ART line and this person's really good at catching the antibiotic that needs to go in and just learning where our niches are and playing to that while also still trying to grow in the areas that we're not as strong.
Yeah, there's no substitute for time on target together, right? Mixed in as a team. I'm always curious though, can we do it slightly cheaper? And I don't mean money, time and energy and shifts together, right? Can we do it quicker? Can we make that cohesion happen in a faster sort of motion? And I think what you're saying is really intelligent, that one of the big inputs to that is how accurate is our read of ourselves.
I think if we could, you get to know a team, having more open dialogue, 360 degree feedback, being able to put our egos away and truly see where we stand with one another. And I think we all have to, again, be able to experience what we look like on good days and bad days, what our teammates look like on good days and bad days, and know what that looks like. I guess the way that I would think that it could be done maybe cheaper, easier, I think there's a huge place in that for probably like simulation training and even virtual simulation training, where to have everyone on a video call, since it's always so hard to get us all together in one place and people have to be able to be in the unit too. But to have kind of these mock situations of a patient case that's decompensating and being able to talk through it and speak to what we're all doing, even if it's us sitting at home on our couches or someone watching their kid, and being able to do that through the technology we have, I feel like there has to be opportunities out there to learn how we all handle the human parts and the human aspects and communication pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some really interesting stuff, visually enhanced mental simulation. There's some stuff from the work of Victoria Brazel and Eve Purdy and their team out in Australia is doing some really interesting stuff around like team cohesion and sim and stuff like that, coupled with these interesting questions like, how do we view ourselves? How do we view the other people on the team? It's sort of like rich layering and like thick slicing of the human element of it, which is awesome. Alex, this has been incredible. Thank you so much for joining and digging in about all of this. I want to give you a chance to issue a challenge to folks, right? Anything that you want them to do differently on their next shift after listening to this, or that you want them to be chewing on. And while you're thinking about that, I'll give our normal disclaimer, which is that everything that we talk about here is designed to help take the best of what other people know and put it into all of our hands. We don't give medical advice on this podcast, and anything that we say are our own opinions and not those of anybody that we work with or for. Just two folks out here in space trying to make the world better. So with that, what do you want people to do? What do you want them to try?
I would say if we could all go into it with the mindset of giving each other grace and recognizing we all came into medicine probably because to varying degrees, we have a desire to help people and we have good intentions. It may not always come across that way, or we may not always express it the way we mean to. But if we can all give each other a little more grace and realize we're on the same team, we have the same goal, I think that certainly helps a lot of the stress and team dynamics and helps morale in general. But I would also say, challenge yourself to ask people for feedback. Ask people from different perspectives of the room to give you feedback and create an environment where they feel comfortable being honest and specific with you. And whether or not you agree with them, it's feedback is a gift, and you just have to be willing to reflect on it and think about it and how that can make you better the next day, so you're not just coming to work in the same form every day. We should all be trying to get a little bit better each time.
Cool. Alex, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thank you for sharing with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com. Or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a mission critical team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's janese@missioncti.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Rowe Productions for helping us produce the Teamcast. Have a great day.